The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, you know, sometimes you just get lucky. You know, where you need a guest with a certain type of expertise, and there they are. Well, we are really lucky today. She's been a great guest with us before, but in particular because we're looking at a possible rate hike. I guess it's this month, since this is December first, but I guess we're looking for a possible rate hike in a couple of weeks. We are fortunate with us today, Ms. Heidi Richardson. Heidi is Global Investment Strategist for BlackRock. Heidi's responsibilities are for relating the investment strategy team's research and development investment views, but she's recently been writing a blog, and the most recent one was on November 28th called In Search of the Rate-Proof Portfolio that I really want to ask her about. So we are very fortunate this morning to have Ms. Heidi Richardson. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. And thank you for so much for being with us today. And I guess this is really perfect for us to have your expertise with us today because it looks like that the real rate hike is finally coming. Do you think it is?
We do. Yeah. We actually think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Amazing. I think if I were Mrs. Yellen, I would do it just to get it all over with. She gets harassed.
Yeah, we've been waiting an awful long time.
Yeah. And it just seems like they harass her to death. They were doing it to Ben Bernanke, and she just kind of picked up that baton, and they've kept after her. Now, do you think there's a real reason to raise rates, or do you think that she's just doing it just because maybe politically or just, like you say, it's just time to do it, but is there a real economic reason to raise rates?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we should have done it a long time ago, quite frankly. And so when we think about the Fed actually starting the process, it's likely to be a quarter of 1%, so 25 basis points in terms of a move. So it's not going to be anything that's going to be catastrophic for the market. But, you know, if we look at the unemployment numbers are strong. If we look at wages and salaries increasing, you know, we've seen some strength there. If we look at the non-farm payrolls, it was a Dana report last month. Of course, we have another report coming up this Friday. But I think, you know, our base case is that the Fed's going to move in December after the 15th, 16th meeting.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree with you, and I think they will. And I agree with you on the initial rate. What is your outlook, or do you guys have a prognostication on what you think it might look at after that? There are some people that are saying it's going to be a one and done. There are others that are coming out and saying, no, look for a full point over a year period of time. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a couple of things. First, I don't necessarily think it'll be a one and done. I think what they'll do is they'll raise and then they'll sort of assess the damage in the wake and see how the market reacts. You know, I think that it's unlikely that it'll be similar to the last time we saw a rate hike, which was, you know, 17 consecutive moves of about 25 basis points. So if you ever heard the expression, the staircase pattern, it's really looking at that rising rate of 25 basis points at each meeting. I think that's highly unlikely. But if we look out 12 months, could we see, you know, 75 basis points or 0.75% move? Yeah. And you know what? If we do get to that point, I think it's just because the U.S. economy is solid. And so the Fed's not worried about it. And I think that should be a positive for investors.
Yeah, that would be a positive for investors, and I guess you're right. They'll just wait and see how the market responds to it. And so you wrote this article, In Search of the Rate-Proof Portfolio. And can you talk to us a little bit about the article?
Yeah, so, you know, it's just one of the blogs. I tend to blog every week or two just in terms of opportunities in the marketplace. And I think so many people are just focused on when rates go up, bond prices go down. But it actually creates opportunities for investors as well. And I think there's select opportunities in the U.S. equity market, and then there's ways to try to protect your portfolio in the fixed income market as well, so to protect some of that downside in your bond. And I think particularly focusing on the U.S. equity market, you know, there are opportunities for areas that benefit from rising rates. So if you think about financials as an example, you know, if the Fed raises interest rates by 25 basis points, The banks will generally pass on some portion of that to depositors, but they're likely to charge more on their loans moving forward. And so when we think about that difference of what they have to pay their depositors versus what they're getting on the bonds and the loans that they're lending out, you know, that's usually an increasing margin. And so it's good for the net interest margin of these financial companies. So we think financials and some of these cyclical areas of the marketplace offer some better opportunities for investors and some of the defensive things that have gotten expensive over the last couple of years, like consumer staples and utilities and some of those areas. You know, and I like technology companies as well. Technology companies have done very well this year, and I think that's likely to continue because if we look at, there's 10 sectors in the S&P, what we call GICS sectors, and if we look at the technology sector, it's really the only one that has a super strong cash position. And so when you think about that, if interest rates are rising and people that are, have a lot of debt, whether it's consumers or businesses, their cost of financing that debt increases. But when you have a lot of cash in your balance sheet, so you're much less vulnerable to rising interest rates. Plus, you can deploy that cash in a shareholder-friendly way, like increasing your dividends, doing share buybacks, increasing merger and acquisition activity, all things we've seen over the last year or two in technology.
Yeah, and I also noticed, I read your article. I thought it was a great, I mean, your blog, and I thought it was great. You like dividend growers. I'm a big fan of dividend growers. And you also made an interesting point, which I hadn't thought of. You like corporate bonds. Over holding treasuries.
Yeah, so if you think about with dividend growers, first of all, are more reasonably priced than the high dividend paying counterparts. And so when we think about that, high dividend payers, a lot of times you have to finance that by issuing debt, right?
Right.
So you're leveraging yourself up to be able to increase those dividends. Where dividend growers are in the areas like technology and some cyclical areas that consistently grow their dividends out of their strong earnings year after year. So I think the dividend growers look more attractive than the high dividend payers. And then when we think about adding some corporate bonds, if you think about a corporate bond, it's less vulnerable to rising interest rates because if you think about a corporation issuing a bond, it's more important about the credit quality of that issuer and whether they're going to pay back that debt than it is on what happens with the Fed and raising interest rates. So I think you get a better yield advantage over treasuries by going into corporates, and I think they're less vulnerable in the rising rate environment.
Now, you mentioned in the blog, and you excluded interest rate-sensitive REITs when you were talking about positioning for the rate rise. I've always been curious because, you know, if you've got a stronger economy behind forcing a rise in rates, you generally are going to have inflation involved in there somewhere. Now, we haven't seen inflation for a long time. But then inflation directly translates in the real estate market, the cost of building buildings and homes and things like that. You would think that REITs would benefit in the long run from rising rates. Do they benefit in the long run but just get hit in the short run?
Well, I think there's more volatility in the short run. I think potentially if we do get into a period of a rising inflationary environment, which inflation's been relatively benign for the last couple of years. But if we do get closer to that 2% target from the U.S. Fed, then I think that REITs make sense over a longer term. But I think in terms of looking at the reaction in the shorter term, they're going to be much more volatile. So we do prefer having exposure to U.S. financials ex the REIT sector right now.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. You also wrote an interesting blog a couple months ago. I'll have to take you back there a little bit. Ideas for your bond portfolio when it rises. And there are two ways, you said, to prepare. One you just talked about a little bit about credit. But the other was know your duration. You said know where to hold your duration. Can you explain to the folks what you mean by that?
Yeah. So if we think about it, so we all know just from Basic Investing 101, that if bond yields rise, the price of those bonds decline. And so when we think about that, the longer you have for a maturity on a bond, the more volatile it is and the more interest rate exposure there is to that rising interest rate. So shortening up that duration, having less interest rate exposure will be important.
Yeah, and I agree. And then, of course, you mentioned there that to focus on credit, and obviously you want to go for the best credit that you can. You also talk, we only got 30 seconds, but you also talk about a credit spread. Can you tell them what a credit spread is in 30 seconds?
Yeah, so if we look at treasuries, treasuries are risk-free, it's a risk-free rate. And so whatever the yield is over treasuries, that's looking at the spread. So are you being compensated for taking that risk?
Yeah, that's your credit spread. Folks, hang on. We'll be back with Heidi Richardson in just a few moments. Stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We have with us today Ms. Heidi Richardson. Heidi is head of U.S. Global Strategy for iShares. Those are the shares brought up by BlackRock. She is responsible for relating the investment team strategy, their research, and their investment ideas, and she's sharing those with us this morning. We talked the last segment about the potential, the highly likely. In fact, I think Wall Street is pegging the number right now at about 68 to 70% that the Fed will raise rates here in a few weeks. We talked about that in the last segment. We're going to talk in this segment. We're going to get Heidi and BlackRock's thoughts on the equity market. Anyway, Heidi, I'd like to shift over to equities now. And interesting that this morning, and I didn't really get a chance to really go over it with the listeners, but big news out this morning is that the headline was there's little doubt that the global economy is slowing because South Korea's exports, which is South Korea is often referred to as the world's economic canary in the coal mine, actually fell 4.7% in November from a year earlier. And I guess the reason they call it the world's canary in a coal mine is because their world imports, which are as varied as automobiles, petrochemicals, and electronics, really represent kind of what's done, what's being bought around the world. What are your thoughts about the emerging markets and about the economy of the world in general and then in the United States?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I mean, I think, you know, we are seeing the global economy slowing down. If we look at China, particularly in the emerging markets, we've seen China slow down. But, you know, China's slowing down for a lot of the right reasons in terms of the structural reforms that are going on in China. You know, when China was hitting the double-digit economic growth rate, their, you know, 10, 11% GDP, it was doing that by being an investment-led economy. And so what I mean by that is if they had a target rate of 10% economic growth and they weren't achieving that, they would go out and build something, build an airport, build a bridge, build a city. That's why we see 60-minute episodes of ghost cities and those types of things. So what they're trying to do with the structural reform is be much more of a consumer-driven economy like the U.S. Two-thirds of our economy is driven by the consumer. And so they're moving in all the right steps to do that, but it's like turning a tanker around in the ocean. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think that all the steps that they're taking are going to be really a positive for China. And so thinking about that, I'd rather have a 5 or 6% economic growth that's sustainable than a 10% economic growth of just going and building something to try to achieve that. So when I think about the emerging markets, there's a lot of headline news, particularly about China slowing and the impact on commodities and some of these other areas. But I do think that when we look out over the next 5 years, China's going to be a leader. The currency was just added into the IMF in terms of a reserve currency. So I'm less worried about the emerging markets from that sense. And if we look at the valuations of emerging markets, you know, they're at 12-year lows compared to the developed economies. And so I'm not necessarily saying buy it right now because it's cheap, but you know what? Eventually, it's going to be a turning point for these emerging markets. These things go in cycles, and I think you know these valuations are starting to look very attractive.
So, but you're not saying that we've actually bottomed out over there yet. I mean, there seems to be one of the problems with Chinese, and I'm just talking from a consumer standpoint, not a Wall Street standpoint, is that, you know, you're always getting these numbers from China, and then right behind it, whoever's giving you those numbers is always following up. Well, you may not be able to trust these numbers because we don't really trust the numbers out of China, so we're just kind of throwing these numbers out, but don't really trust the numbers. When do you begin to trust the numbers in China?
I mean, I think, well, a couple of things. First of all, we could say that about Russia. We could say that about Argentina. You know, we could say that about a lot of countries in terms of not necessarily being able to trust the numbers. But I do think that the new leadership with Li and Xi, they're doing all the right things. And I think that, you know, fighting corruption and the steps that they're taking from the reforms that are going on there, I do think that we can start to trust the numbers even more so that are being reported. And I do think these economic growth numbers, even if we look at it and say, let's say it's 6%, if the U.S. economy is growing at 2.5%, it's more than twice what the U.S. economy is growing at, and it's the second largest economy in the world. So 6% isn't a bad number.
No, it's not at all. So you're beginning to look carefully at China, and I guess assume that from there you'll see more strength in the emerging markets. So what about Europe? It seems like everybody, you know, I was talking to Heidi during the break, folks, and I hadn't shared this with you yet, but Société Générale says the whole party comes to an end in 2017. We both kind of laughed about that. That's kind of prediction. It's kind of out there a little bit and kind of difficult to make and back up, but, you know, they feel like the bull market will be over with. We'll get a sell-off, and they think it'll start recovering again in 2020. But they do think that we're going to be in a rough time for, apparently, in the articles 17, 18, and 19. But, Heidi, even in the midst of that prognostication, they come out and they say, we like Europe and we like Japan. Now, that's, as you mentioned, the last time you were on, you mentioned that. And that has been kind of refrained over and over again from different parties on Wall Street. Is it still intact, the theme that we like Europe and we like Japan?
Yeah, you know, and it all comes down to central bank policy, right? So if we think about why the U.S. market had this six-year bull market run, it was based on the Fed and coming to a zero interest rate environment, trying to stimulate growth, trying to stimulate lending out there in the marketplace. And now we see Europe in the early innings of doing that. And so when we think about the central bank policy coming out of the European Central Bank and Mario Draghi, you know, they're trying to do whatever it takes to get Europe back on its feet. And they've stated that they're going to be doing aggressive quantitative easing, again, trying to get to that zero interest rate environment, if you will, between now and September 2016. And we think it's likely to extend even further than 2016. And we think the magnitude of the quantitative easing is likely to be even more than originally anticipated. So just like the tailwind that we got in the U.S. marketplace, I think you're going to be getting something very, very similar in Europe. If we look at Europe equities, Eurozone equities are yielding about 3.5%, and a German government bond locking your money up for 10 years is yielding less than 0.5%. You know, so it encourages investors to go into equities in those particular regions to try to reach for income. They have the same demographics that we do in terms of aging population, the post-World War II baby boom society, and they need income. So I think you're going to see a surge in equities in Europe. And then Japan's very similar. They've been embarking on the central bank policy for the last couple of years, but it's likely to continue as we move forward the next couple of years. And so I think that's going to be a positive for Japanese equity. And with the Japan Post IPO that we saw a couple of weeks ago, it was really favorable, and it's attracted more attention from both domestic investors and non-Japan investors to buy Japanese equities.
Now, does the aging population in Japan tend to bother you at all? You know, when people really get into Japan, when I'm reading reports on Japan, it always invariably gets around to their demographics, and the demographics in Japan are very poor. They sell more adult diapers there than baby diapers. Does that cause any concern long-term investing in Japan?
No, well, I mean, I think if we're looking out over 20 years, then, you know, it could potentially be an issue over the next 20 years. If we look out over the next 5 to 10 years, I'm not concerned any more than I am with the aging population in the U.S. or Europe.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for being with us. Very kind. We only have about 30 seconds. Any sectors in the United States that BlackRock really is interested in?
No, and I mentioned we like cyclicals over defensive, so we like technology and financials and some of these dividend growers more so than the defensive, like consumers, staples and utilities and some of those high dividend payers that have more debt.
All right. Great. Heidi, thank you so much. I hope you and your family have a happy holidays, ma'am. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, ma'am. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.